Sai Ram from Prashanti Nilayam. Dear listeners, Radio Sai continues its weekly presentation of the talking book version of Mr. Howard Moffat's highly acclaimed book, Sai Baba, Man of Miracles. The author was among the very early Westerners who came to Satya Sai Baba as a skeptic in 1964, and drawn by his enigma, he stayed for considerable periods of time near him in the next 6 years. During this period, he conducted extensive research and probing investigations into the Sai phenomena. He published his findings as the book that has become a classic of Sai literature, often considered the primer which introduced Sri Satya Sai Baba to millions round the world. This book was first published in 1971. Since then, it has been instrumental in drawing millions of seekers to the loving path of Satya Sai. These readings, dear listeners, are being aired every week, and if you wish to revisit a chapter at any time, you can do so at our website radiosai.org. So dear listeners, welcome now to Sai Baba, Man of Miracles by Howard Moffat.
Sai Ram, and welcome to this talking book session of excerpts from Mr. Howard Moffat's book, Sai Baba, Man of Miracles. We are now at a critical juncture of the author's study, investigation, and understanding of Sri Satya Sai Baba's miracles. Here in chapter 18, entitled Reality and Significance of the Miraculous, he once again starts off with a quote from Sri Aurobindo, which states, quote, "Flake of the world fire, spark of divinity, lift up thy mind and thy heart into glory. Sun in the darkness, recover thy luster." Unquote. Clearly, today's session is very important and quite unique. Unlike the previous sessions in which we heard Mr. Moffat either narrate personal experiences or recount his fellow devotees' experiences with Swami, today we hear him interpret the reality and significance of Baba's miracles. Mr. Moffat begins by saying that though Sri Satya Sai Baba's miracles are indisputable facts for the many eminent devotees whom he had met, and also to himself, the eyewitnesses to such miracles form only a small fraction of mankind. That leaves millions beyond the orbit of those who have been fortunate enough to see and feel divinity for themselves. What then happens to the masses of materialists and atheists who have been conditioned by the superficial philosophy of modern technological progress? In this manner, Mr. Moffat's mind wanders if there is even the slightest likelihood that the humanity which is not in the know of Swami's divinity will credit the truth of the incredible events described in these pages. Let us listen to what he says.
"The human mind, by its nature, regards anything outside a commonly accepted framework of rationality as impossible and rejects it. A materialization phenomenon, for example, is so foreign to everyday experience that even after watching it happen, it is not easy for one to believe that it really took place. One seems to have been in some odd way out of space and time. When one is back in the normal dimensions of space and time, the reality of a miracle seems to vanish. It goes as the reality of a dream goes on waking. Did the miracle really happen? The thinking mind asks. But the glittering jewel, which came from nowhere, lies in the hand. The taste of the candy, which a moment ago was granite or paper, is undeniably on the tongue. The effects are apparent. The comprehensible causes are missing, and they are not to be found by our rationalistic thinking. Of course, the apport, The transport of a material object without any known material agency is well known to spiritualists and other occult circles of the West. I myself have witnessed them there. The theory behind them is that the object, which is already in existence somewhere, is dematerialized and brought in that state by psychic force to the circle where it is rematerialized. Baba has said that some of his productions are apports. In this regard, the observation of one Sai devotee is suggestive. A well-known Indian princess told me that she was once sitting close in front of Baba while he stood above her on a dais, waving his hand to produce something. She was able to look for anything happening beneath the downturned palm. First, she saw a small luminous cloud appear there. This condensed quickly to form a small shining object over which Baba's hand closed. The object proved to be a gold ring. The old gold $10 piece which Baba produced for me at Horsley Hills was no doubt an apport. But what of the interesting phenomenon he performed for Dr. V.K. Gokak, Vice Chancellor of Bangalore University? On an early visit to Dr. Gokak's house, Baba saw on the wall for the first time a portrait of an Indian saint, Sri Panta Maharaj of Balekundri, and asked about its presence there. The Vice Chancellor replied to Baba that the saint had been his father's guru and that he himself held the holy man in great reverence. Baba, have you a smaller portrait of him to carry when you are traveling? Dr. Gokak, no. Baba, would you like one? Dr. Gokak, yes, Swami, very much. Baba waved his hand for a little longer than usual, remarking, he is coming. Turning the palm up, he handed the doctor a small enamel pendant. It bore a miniature replica of the saint's portrait. Apports are perhaps better known to all classes in India than to those in the West. The ex-government minister, great educationalist and well-known writer Dr. K.M. Munshi states in his excellent Bhavan's journal that he has seen apports produced by a man sitting near him on the sofa of his own drawing room. First there was kumkum on a tray, another time flowers, a third time prasad, and a fourth time currency notes. Munshi goes on to say that he thinks the sacred ash materialized by Baba and used for curing ailments and evoking faith must amount to a pound in weight per day and is not apported, but produced in some other, even more mysterious way. It seems obvious that the sweets made while you watch from age-old solid rock and many other phenomena performed by Sai Baba cannot be apports. But whether objects are transported, created on the spot by divine will, or materialized in some other way, what amount of evidence, what number of attestations from people of intelligence and integrity does it take to convince those who have never seen such things? Of course, within India itself, there are large numbers of people who have no difficulty whatsoever in accepting the reality of miracles. Beneath the surface of life, the miraculous has always been going on in that country. There have always been men who could perform some supernormal feat or another, create a perfume from the air, read a sealed letter, crack a tumbler from a distance, heal with a touch, drink strong acid with impunity, levitate, and so on. These things are part of the fabric of the common culture. They are accepted not only by the masses, but by thinkers and thought leaders of the status of Dr. K.M. Munshi, for instance. On this subject, I have spoken to many of the well-educated and highly cultured. Most of them have seen some examples during their lives of miraculous phenomena, quite apart from the Sai Baba miracles. The possibility of siddhis is so basic to the Indian heritage that even those who have never seen anything of the kind are ready to believe in the miraculous.
But there is a problem even with such beliefs. Let us hear what it is.
Yet, for this very reason, it seems to me, some of the intelligent are inclined to miss the main point of the Sai Baba miracles. I have heard them say, advanced yogis are able to perform miracles. But so what? What is the value in such things? Some go further and say that miracles should not be performed, that they are an obstacle to spiritual progress. They quote statements from their scriptures and yogic texts to support this view. But if we examine such statements properly, we find that the warnings about the perils of performing miracles are given to disciples, to those at an intermediate stage on the spiritual path. Patanjali, for instance, points out that at some level of training in yoga, latent supernormal powers of various kinds are liable to make their appearance. That is to say, the disciple will find that he has the power to perform certain miracles. But there are several grave dangers inherent in this. It may stir his pride and egotism. He may start using it for selfish purposes. It may make him think that he has reached his goal. Instead of understanding that these psychic and psychokinetic powers are mere byproducts, he may consider them the final product, or at least a sign that he has reached a high level of spirituality. But psychic powers are not in themselves a sign of spirituality. Thus the pupil, enamored of such powers, will be led astray and make no further progress towards life's true goal. Baba himself, while in his former body at Shirdi, often gave warnings to his devotees on this matter. He pointed out that the acquirement of supernormal powers often takes a disciple who has not reached the highest levels farther away from the main object of his spiritual disciplines, which is the realization of God. But such dangers and such warnings apply only to chelas, pupils on the path, not to those who have reached the final goal, not to a fully God-realized man, a God-man or avatar. There is no desire for earthly gain, no pride, no egotism, no self-glory in the miracles of a Christ, a Krishna and a Sai Baba. Therefore, there is no danger neither to the performer of the miracle or to the recipient of its benefits. However, though the recipient can suffer no ill effects from divine miracles, he may not always obtain all the good effects potentially there. To every such miracle, there is a spiritual string, so to speak. If the receiver fails to perceive the string, he has lost a golden opportunity. He may perhaps have gained a golden jewel, or he may have been blessed by merciful healing, helped in a practical problem, or saved from some deadly peril. These are important things, no doubt, but small compared with what he might have gained. If he continues to dodge the spiritual string, he will in time become surfeited with miraculous phenomena. They will no longer impress or delight him. Moreover, they will not continue to serve him, and when the point is reached where the miraculous powers of the God-man work no more, that materialist's way, where he no longer gets the worldly benefit he expects, he will drop away from the God-man's following.
So what then is the significance of Baba's miracles, we may wonder? The author goes on to explain.
What then is the significance of the divine miracle, the high transcendental magic that works, never for the benefit of the performer, but always for mankind? Some of its purposes are obvious, some are hidden. Miracles do tend to lead men towards investigation and inquiry into the deepest mysteries of the universe. Colonel H.S. Olcott, after seeing a stream of miraculous phenomena during the final quarter of last century, wrote, "For my part, I can say that the great range of marvels of educated will potency which I saw made it easy for me to understand the Oriental theories of spiritual science." This effect, helping the understanding of spiritual science, the miraculous will have on minds that are open, alive and anxious to explore the deeper strata of existence. Though the wonders in themselves are subordinate to and less important than the spiritual truths behind them, they are signs more powerful than words to guide men towards these truths, which at their deepest levels cannot be expressed by either wonders or words. For men are in general apathetic and need something spectacular to shake them out of their inertia. B.V. Narasimha Swami wrote, "One common feature in the lives of both Sai and Jesus is that people always had to be convinced of the divine nature of the two only through the miracles they performed. Miracles are a concession that divinity allows for human blindness." When the Almighty ordered Moses to lead the people of Israel out of Egypt, Moses protested that the people would not believe he was sent by God and would not accept him as their leader. So the Almighty told him to throw his staff on the ground. Obeying, Moses saw the staff become a serpent. Then the Lord ordered him to pick up the serpent by its tail, and doing so, he found the serpent was a staff again. This was the first of the many miracles that Moses was able to perform through the power of God. The purpose of such marvels was not only to make the Israelites and Pharaoh realize that Moses was a divine messenger, but also to overcome the many tremendous obstacles in the long journey from bondage in Egypt to freedom in the promised land. Like all the immortal stories of man's pilgrimage, this one has deeper meaning too. It teaches, among other things, that miraculous powers have a value in freeing man from the bondage of the flesh, leading him through the many obstacles of life and his own vain mental strivings to the promised land of spiritual freedom and liberation. So, beginning with the nucleus of disciples around him, the God-man uses miracles to help them grasp the truth about his divine nature and also to help them overcome blockages in their spiritual progress. The nucleus of disciples grows to a large following, and gradually, as the religious history of the past shows, the good news, the gospel spreads until millions become his followers. Thereby, the heavy karma of mankind is lifted a little, and more souls are brought from darkness towards the light. But it is wise to remember that the greatest miracles are not always the obvious ones. In the presence of the man of divinity, our awakening spiritual perception beholds a demonstration of the most stupendous miracle in the very existence of such a man. We, who are ourselves bond slaves to desire, see one who is master of earthly desire. We, who are always centered in our little, separate, self-important selves, see one who is centered in the self of all mankind, all life. We, who struggle on through sorrow and passing joys, see the embodiment of eternal joy. We, who constantly confuse love with lust, possessiveness, self-love, feel from the Great One the nectarine flow of a love that is divine, universal, embracing all life. Yet at the same time, this love is not vague and impersonal. It is very personal, focused on each devotee's innermost heart, and in it there is no taint of egotism.
Indeed, a very beautiful interpretation. God's greatest miracles are not always the obvious ones. Mr. Murfitt goes on further to explain these.
If our feet are on even the beginning of the spiritual path, we know that these great qualities are goals towards which we ourselves are struggling in life's pilgrimage. But often such goals have seemed a long way off. We have wondered sometimes if we could ever reach them, if any human being ever really came to them. Perhaps, after all we ponder, they are no more than a beautiful dream of the heart. But now, before us in the flesh is one who has scaled the spiritual Everest. An ideal, a dream, has thus become an actual living reality in time. Human nature, we thus see, can indeed be changed. The lower animal self of man can be completely transmuted into a higher self. Here lies perhaps the deepest significance of divine miracles. They demonstrate the godlike potentialities, the flake of the world fire in each human being. They build our faith and help us to work with new zeal towards the production of a divine edition of ourselves. And this is accomplished not only through the great inspiration of the living example before us, but also through the silent, transforming ray that emanates from the Divine One and, unbeknown to us, reaches to our depths. By his very nature of pure love, the Avatar calls all men to him, and the many that come he guides along the razor-edged way. Sai Baba, while still in his Shirdi body, stated that he would lead hundreds of thousands of people onto the path and take them to the goal, right up to the very end, right to God. On this work, he is still energetically engaged. There is little doubt that all continents and all peoples will have the chance to see Sai Baba in the years ahead. So here is something never known before in the world's history. A God-man, a living worker of miracles, will be able through the use of modern global communications to travel the world and make his message known to all people during his lifetime. Of old, this could not happen, and tidings of such amazing events reached the mass of mankind either through verbal reports or by accounts written long after the events took place. Now the skeptic, the doubting Thomas, who cannot believe in either the greater or the lesser miracles, can prove their reality for himself. If keen enough, he can visit Prashanthi Nilayam to witness them. Otherwise, he can wait until Sai Baba comes nearer to his part of the globe. The miracles of Christ and Krishna must be taken on trust or through faith. Those of Sai Baba you can see for yourself.
That was a prolific interpretation of Sri Sathya Sai Baba's miracles, which drive home the basic essence and deeper significance of such occurrences. For today, we leave you to ponder over these profound thoughts. Till we meet the next time, all the best and Jai Sai Ram. You have been listening to a presentation of excerpts from Mr. Howard Murfitt's book, Sai Baba, Man of Miracles. This book has been published in 1971 by Frederick Miller Limited in London.